It's really an honor and pleasure to be here, and I'm always happy to speak before the World Affairs Council, extraordinary organization. And I am really heartened to see the extent of interest in this community in international affairs in the Middle East in particular. I know the choices that you have. And I always say that today when my students come to me in the university asking what they should do before they leave college, and I say study abroad, because I think today it is impossible to live in this world and succeed without being connected to the rest of the world and learning more about it. So I'm really very happy to see the degree of which there is interest in the Middle East and international affairs broadly. I know that when you hear the news or watch the news on TV today, it's very hard not to notice the pain and violence and uncertainty, in some cases destruction, that is underway in the Middle East. We see what's happening in Syria, the thousands that have been killed, the many refugees, the homeless, the destruction, the struggle, the uncertainty that is ongoing every single day. We see even in places that we thought were happily resolved after the revolution, such as Egypt, that we have an ongoing struggle with thousands of demonstrators on both sides of different issues, with challenges to the president, divide over the constitution, several people dying in those demonstrations last week. And we saw what happened just a few weeks ago in Gaza, in the war between Israel and Hamas, with dozens of people killed and wounded, and many children on both sides having to sleep in fear and trembling for 8 days, and think about what might happen to them as they grow up. It is a very uncertain time in the Middle East, and I contrasted that in some ways with the euphoria that emerged right after the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt that were happily, mostly peaceful, that seemed to suggest that there's one tide that is going forward, that these are historical events that are likely to transform the region in a big way. In fact, it is fascinating because I also do polling here in the United States, not only in the Arab world and Israel. And one of the things I test for is American public views toward the Middle East. So right after the revolution in Egypt itself, I conducted a poll in April to just check out how the American public is perceiving these changes. Do they see them as positives? Do they see them as negative? How are they evaluating the Arab people and the Muslim people? Are they optimistic about the future? And it was interesting because in an article I wrote right after, I concluded that there may be, in fact, a change in the American public paradigm about the Arab world, maybe an Arab Spring paradigm contrasted with the horrific and painful paradigm of 9/11. In part, we found that majorities of people right after these events had favorable views of Arab people and Muslim people, particularly the Egyptian people. We found that a majority of Americans thought that these revolts were mostly about ordinary people seeking freedom and democracy, and fewer people said it was about Islamic groups trying to take over. But what we've seen just in a few weeks ago in the latest poll that we've done on this issue is that there has been even a transformation in the American public view of what's happening in the Middle East. Now, more people think that what's happening in the Middle East is less about ordinary people seeking freedom and democracy and more about Islamic groups taking control. One reason for that, obviously, is the fact that Islamists won in both Tunisia and Egypt, and we have a Muslim Brotherhood president in Egypt. Another reason is that Islamic groups are very active in the opposition in Syria, even though the administration and really much of Arab public opinion is against the Assad regime in Syria. It is obvious that there is a much of the opposition, particularly the militant opposition, is from Islamist groups, in some cases very radical Islamic groups, including Al-Qaeda. So for that reason, there is a kind of a changed perception in the American public. It's still a fluid environment, but it's becoming more negative than positive in contrast to what it was roughly 2 years ago when all this started. And so more and more you find people, this is really about history repeating itself. These uprisings are just episodic, the likes of which you've witnessed before. You have these revolts, and then somebody else takes over, and then we go back to the same types of things that have taken place in the Middle East over and over again. I want to suggest to you at the outset that I think that is a mistaken view. That is a wrong view. What I would like to argue today to you that we are witnessing in the Middle East transformative events that are likely to change the rules of the game in every Arab country. The relationship between the ruled and the rulers, and the relationship between Arabs and the rest of the world. These are not episodic events. These are events that are huge, and they signal something that is irreversible. It doesn't mean that we're going to predict where it's going to go in country to country, but it is hugely important. What I'd like to do at the outset is give you my interpretation of why I think these are transformative events, and there is no going back. Let me begin with a puzzle. And the puzzle is that when you look at these events that happened 2 years ago, started 2 years ago, huge revolts, hundreds of thousands of people going into the streets of Tunisia, hundreds of thousands of people, actually millions, going into the streets of Egypt, and then two entrenched governments toppled, followed by two more entrenched governments being toppled, the one in Libya and the one in Yemen. By the way, between the four of them, these four rulers had been in power for over 100 years, just to think about that. So these are extraordinary events that took place at that time. But the puzzle is, given the magnitude of what happened for all these people who are watching the Middle East, the analysts, and the governments who had to fear for the consequences, who had to fear for their survival in these events, no one really predicted the scale of the events. No one really predicted the timing of these events. So the question is, why, with all the information that we had, what is it that led us to not really understand that something big was going to happen? So let me tell you why I think most analysts did not predict these events. Let's start with what we knew. It isn't that analysts didn't know that angry people in the Arab world were a huge majority and they were desperate for change of regimes. That we knew. No one really deluded themselves about this issue. In the public opinion polls that I have been doing for a decade, every time I come back after the poll and I give my results, my conclusion is that the gap between people and governments is only growing every year, that people are angry, that these governments are not representing the people, that when governments speak, the public says they don't speak for me. We understood that on big issues and small over a period of a decade. And I wasn't the only one. Any analysts, we didn't even need public opinion polls to tell us that. A lot of analysts and governments, and even our own government officials, knew that that was the case. So the problem was not that we didn't know that people were angry enough to want to topple their governments. That was known. That was not a surprise. It didn't surprise any analyst, and probably didn't even surprise the governments themselves, because they were very much attuned to the anger of the public and found ways to muffle it. So the surprise was different kind, because most people who looked at the Arab world and Muslim countries in general said that, look, it's not enough to have angry people to have a revolt. You need to get people into the streets. You need, in order for people to make a difference, to influence governments, to topple them, they have to organize in a way that matters, that challenges the security services, that challenges the institutions of the state, that brings out thousands into the streets. And how do you do that if you don't have organized opposition and organized parties and organized social institutions and charismatic leadership? So all of us assumed that in order to have that kind of organization, you need institutions. And that's what governments assume. So that's why for decades they have prevented the emergence of serious opposition to them. So every time there's a party that could challenge them, they will outlaw it, or they will watch it, or they will arrest its leaders. And every time a leader emerged that had charisma, that had the potential of challenging a ruler, they were, of course, put away or undermined or co-opted. So for that reason, when people looked around and said, well, where is the organization going to come from to translate anger into revolt? Keeping in mind, revolutions are rare in history anyway. How often, how many have you witnessed anywhere around the world? Not many. Even in the Middle East history, really only the Iranian Revolution of 79 was a popular revolution. So keeping that in mind, it wasn't a surprise. So why did it happen then in 2010 that we had that many people going to the streets? Well, first, the causes had not changed. In fact, when you look at what drives people's anger with the regimes, you don't find a particularly striking set of conditions, whether they're economic or political or repression, that were unique to 2010 or 2011 in any of these countries. There were always economic crises like that that have happened before. There was no single event or single set of conditions that you can say it was different and striking and created a kind of reaction we hadn't witnessed before. What was different is that the people of Tunisia and the people of Egypt and ultimately the people everywhere around the world, in the Arab world, were able to organize and get thousands of people into the streets because of the information revolution. The information revolution was not the cause of anger, don't get me wrong. That is not why people got angry. People were angry because governments didn't represent them, because governments didn't provide what they needed, whether it was economic conditions or freedom at the local level or represent them in foreign policy. But the information revolution connected them in ways that were not connected before and enabled them to communicate and get out to the streets in a big way without the need for political parties, without the need for social institutions, without the need for charismatic leaders. In fact, when you look at the early organizers, they were nameless people, men and women, mostly young. And many of them were not poor and not deprived economically. These were largely middle classes, as often happens in revolutions. It's not really about deprivation as such. People join for different reasons. So these people got into the streets because of this information revolution. And that information revolution has been ongoing for a decade and a half on a big scale. It started really in the middle of 1990s with the expansion of satellite television. And to give you a flavor of what happened, if you looked at 1995 and compared it with 2010, in 1995, most Arabs in the Arab world received their information from government-controlled media, their own government-controlled media, within their own boundaries. In 2000, the majority of Arabs, including in Egypt and Morocco, received their news from media outlets from outside their own boundaries. governments lost control over the narrative very quickly. But more importantly, there was a huge and rapid expansion in the use of the internet, really only in the past 5 to 7 years. I've been tracing this in the polling. In 2007 and 2008, I didn't have enough users of the internet in my data to be able to do significant enough statistical analysis. And in 2011, I had a large share of the public say they now get their news from the internet, a large minority in comparison to people who get their news from television. But the expansion of the internet and social media was remarkable in its ability to help people organize without political parties. But it had another kind of outcome. It's empowering. It is empowering to the individual to have the control of communicating and having feedback almost immediately from people all over the world. And that empowerment that comes with the information revolution, in my opinion, is leading to the rise of the individual Arab. If you contrast this with decades of authoritarianism, where the individual was not central in the political system, but also compare that to traditional societies in the Middle East, where the individual role is also limited in comparison to the collective role, whether it's family or tribe or party or country. And this revolution of information has been empowering to the individual on a scale that we have not seen before. In my opinion, people who say history repeats itself are right up to a point. Of course, history does in some ways. You know, the rules of the games don't change dramatically. It's still about power. It's still about some of the same aspirations. And we see that in the history of every country and every region in the world. But if you look at the history of the West, particularly Western Europe, and if you look at the transformations that have taken place, one of the biggest transformations that have taken place was through the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution, the impact of that was really the transformation of society through the empowerment of individuals that now earned wages. And what we have here is something parallel, though not identical, with the Information Revolution of empowering the individual. We have the empowered individual Arab, not just the empowered public in relation to government, but really the empowered individual. Now, this doesn't happen overnight, and it obviously is not something that bears fruit at once. But what I suggest is it is happening on such a scale that it is only going to move forward, not backward. And the reason for it is this, that the information revolution is only expanding every day in the Arab world. And you look at the data and you see how well-connected Arabs are. I just last month, I was in Saudi Arabia. I was lecturing in various places around the country. I went to a women's college. I spoke with the director. She was talking about the training that the young women students were getting. By the way, in Saudi Arabia, in the colleges, there are more women than men, just like here in the U.S. They don't all get jobs, unfortunately, but they certainly are getting education. And she said, you know, what they do is when they come in, we first teach them research. And the way you do research is through the internet, because without the internet, you can't do research. And she told me that by the end of the first year, she can see their tweets, and they're all critical of the governments, and they're all critical of the role, and they're all critical of society. And so there is a sense of empowerment and enlightenment that come with this information revolution that is irreversible. And the reason I say it's irreversible, because it is tied to the economy. There is no country that can move forward economically without the information revolution. Economic growth in a globalized world is tied to the information revolution. Those countries that are not linked to it will fail, and therefore it is going to only expand. Governments can try to limit the freedom of information on the margins, but they simply cannot do it and sustain the needs of the people. So I see that as a huge change that is likely to expand. But what is the outcome of this stage? What does this all mean? What does it mean to have empowered individuals? Well, first, no longer can governments ignore public opinion. We already know that. Even governments that are not going to be toppled and replaced by democratic order, they are simply too frightened to ignore the public sentiment. So the public sentiment is now a factor in the positions in foreign policy and domestic of every government, impossible to ignore. Second, while you're going to see change across the region as people demand more freedom and democracy, that change is going to play itself differently in every country. And it's going to be not exactly predictable. And the reason for it is that when you have empowered publics, you're empowering everyone, meaning left and right, Sunni and Shia, religious and secular. That means a lot of the fissures in society that have been hidden are also going to come to the forefront, because you're going to have everybody be empowered. And you can see in Cairo today, we thought that in Egypt itself, we have a country that is homogeneous. And it is mostly homogeneous. It's mostly Sunni Muslim with about 10% Coptic Christians that coexisted together with some tension occasionally. But by and large, in comparison to Syria or Bahrain or Iraq or Yemen, Egypt is relatively homogeneous. But that homogeneity doesn't necessarily apply to political divisions or ideological divisions. You have secularists who don't want religion to play a major role in politics. You have religious groups who now have the majority in the parliament and who helped elect a president who hails from the Muslim Brotherhood. And so you're going to have them clash. And as they are now contesting the nature of the Egyptian constitution that is likely to define how Egypt is going to look like 10 years from now and 15 years from now, you can see them mobilizing face-to-face with fears of clashes. Each side is getting out to the street, tens of thousands of people. And in some cases, there was minimal violence that they're both trying to avoid. But you could see that this empowerment doesn't always translate into something that is going to go in a particular path or smoothly necessarily. Second, you're going to see more division where there's sectarianism. We've seen that in Syria. When you look at Syria, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking for a lot of reasons, because you see all the suffering, you see all the bloodshed, you see the magnitude of the disaster, and no one really has answers. In some ways, I would argue to you that this is a case where the international system has failed, because with the information revolution, it's not only that we have people who got empowered, but they have people like you and me and everywhere else around the world who sees what's happening in every country as it happens almost by the hour. And so in 1982, when the Assad father regime killed thousands in northern Syria, very few people saw it. It was reported, but very few people, even contemporaries, knew the magnitude of what happened. There was no pressure, no expectation that something would happen. Today, when you watch it, and you see the suffering, and every caring human being, and we're all connected, even people who don't have particular interest, they want something done. Whether it's an Arab or a non-Arab, they want something done. But there's no one to do it. Because when you look at the international system and the paralysis in the Security Council, that they can't decide on what to do, you're reminded that these institutions have been with us since World War II. And they haven't evolved in the same way that our expectations have evolved. They haven't moved with the information revolution and the economic globalization revolution. And so there is that tragedy. But when you look at Syria, despite all that, which is a clear need for humanitarian intervention, the failure of the international system, what you see is multiple things happening at once that are not easily, that don't lend themselves easily to understanding what side you should be on. Part of it is, on the one hand, there is an Arab revolution like anywhere else, like in Egypt and Tunisia, ordinary people rising up against an authoritarian regime and saying, enough, we want our freedom. There is that for sure. On the other hand, there's also sectarianism. Around the regime, there are people who are the Alawi minority that have dominated, some of the Christians allied with them, who fear for the consequences. The Muslim Brotherhood, on the other hand, trying to topple them because they feel that they're a majority of the population, they don't have enough power. And on top of it, you have these external forces like Al-Qaeda, which reads the need and the opportunity and the vacuum of power, and they're sending fighters from Al-Qaeda to northern Syria to try to take hold in the name of helping the revolution, even though their aims are not exactly freedom and democracy. And then on top of all of that, you have international consultations. The Israelis have an interest in what happens in Syria. Iranians, who have been an ally of the regime in Syria, have an interest in what happens there. Hezbollah, next door in Lebanon, who is an ally of the regime, has an interest. The opponents of Hezbollah in Lebanon want to see the regime topple. The Turks in the north have an interest, and they have to fear for what might happen with the Kurdish issue. So the complexity that comes out of these events isn't really directly related to the revolution and its nature. It is that once you open up the system, all kinds of issues pop up, and it's harder to decide who's going to win and what side to take. And that is part of the dilemma that we have. I'm going to give you just a couple of more examples, and then I'm going to end with a couple of notes on issues. And I know you have a lot of questions, and I want to allow a lot of time for discussion. Let me briefly talk about Bahrain. There's another different kind of example where you have a monarchy in Bahrain that is an ally of the United States with a major naval facility, hosting a major naval facility of the U.S., and also an ally of Saudi Arabia, really sort of the little sister of Saudi Arabia in some ways, right there. And that monarchy in Bahrain is from the Sunni minority. And you have a Shia majority that has opposed the regime, not strictly because of the Shia-Sunni divide, but also because of genuine quest for freedom and democracy, like anywhere else around the world, the Arab world. And yet, of course, what we see in that particular case, it was very easy to focus on the Sunni-Shia divide, and the government moved to crush the uprisings with a Saudi support, and with the U.S. Not liking it, but not resisting it enough, in part because the U.S. has substantial interest in the region that cannot be ignored, and that has to do with Saudi Arabia and oil particularly, and not to mention the American military presence, particularly in Bahrain. So that's another model. A fourth model is what the Saudis did. When the uprisings initially started, undoubtedly the monarchy in Saudi Arabia became nervous. And, you know, every regime became nervous, to be fair. You know, it's not just the Saudis, the king of Jordan, the king of Morocco. Every king and president became uncomfortable because they knew that this could come to them. I mean, when you look at what happened, it started in Tunisia initially. Mubarak was asked, could this happen in Egypt? Says he laughed at it. He said, of course not. We're not Tunisia. And you know what happened a few weeks later. So many of them were very uncomfortable. But the Saudis had a different answer to it, which is they are a very rich country with a lot of cash, and they use the cash to buffer their population, offer raises, bolster the security services, offer benefits, The king announced billions of dollars in packages to the population to try to lessen the chance that they would revolt. And so far, the Saudi Arabia has not erupted on a big scale. There were some instances where there were revolts. And so money up to a point seems to buy time. But what I want to say is money will simply not prevent this tide of history from moving forward. The reason is that in the end, this revolt by the Arab people isn't simply about the economy. It is partly that. We all know that economic deprivation does lead to political action, though not always directly. It certainly is a factor in the calculations of people everywhere, whether you're Arab or not. But this is much bigger than that. It is about empowerment. It is about freedom. It is about individual rights. It is about wanting a government to stand for who you are, that you can identify with. In fact, if you look at the chants in the Arab revolutions, whether it was in Egypt or in Tunisia or in Yemen, what people said, and in Libya, by the way, what people said after the toppling of the regime when they went in the hundreds of thousands into the street to celebrate, the big chant was, "Raise your head high, you're an Egyptian. Raise your head high, you're a Libyan. Raise your head high, you're a Tunisian." Because this is a revolution about dignity in the first place. And that is something that I don't think will be addressed simply by economic incentives. Let me end by mentioning some political issues that are affected by these uprisings, and then I'll open it for questions. Let me start by some of the regional issues we have ongoing. The first that come to mind is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict more broadly. And how has this been affected by the Arab uprisings? Let me start by saying that the Arab-Israeli issue is what I call the prism of pain through which Arabs see the world. It is central for how the Arab public defines itself. It is an issue that we've seen in the polls is at the center of how they define their relations with the outside world, particularly the United States. And we have seen over the decade that Arabs are more angry about the Palestinian issue, and particularly the American role in it, than the rest of Arab governments. And so now their voices are going to be more reflected on this issue. And we've seen that already in the recent crisis between Gaza and Israel, the recent war between Gaza and Israel. The Egyptian government, which is democratically elected, rushed to try to end it and played a major role on the side of the Palestinians to try to end it. And just before that, when tensions were being raised, for the first time, Arab rulers, including the Emir of Qatar, went to Gaza, where Hamas is, for the first time, and a prominent head of state comes to Gaza during that period. So it is empowering on the question of Palestine as well, and therefore Israelis feel uncomfortable about it. I also do a poll, by the way, in Israel about various issues of foreign policy, but I also asked the Israeli people about their view of the Arab uprisings, and actually more people think that this is about ordinary people wanting freedom and democracy than they think it's about Islamic groups. But most of them think the Arab uprisings are bad for them, in large part because they realize that the public, the Arab public, is more angry with them than the regimes that they were dealing with, such as Mubarak. Second impact on that is that for the Israeli policy in the region and tied to American policy in the region, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty has been the cornerstone of Israeli security policy and has been actually the cornerstone of American policy toward the Arab-Israeli issue. That treaty, some people fear, may be in jeopardy because most certainly the current government, which is more reflective of the Egyptian public opinion, is less warm toward Israel, and some people even are calling for cutting ties with Israel. In my own public opinion polls in Egypt, I don't see that as an immediate possibility. People in Egypt are divided on this one, and it's not in the interest of the government of Egypt, including this government of President Morsi, to cut relations or end the peace treaty, but there is no going back to the old strategic alliance that Mubarak had with Israel. And for that reason, Israelis feel a little bit uncomfortable about what is happening in the relationship with Egypt. Let me just speak about the impact of the uprisings in attitudes toward the United States. I needn't tell you that attitudes in the Middle East toward the United States have been very negative throughout much of the past decade. Really, this has preceded 9/11, to be fair, but since 9/11, and particularly since the Iraq War, it has gotten much worse. And that continued, really, even through the Obama administration. But when the Arab uprising started, there was a slight warming up to the U.S., still very negative views of the U.S., but somewhat less negative views of the U.S. In large part, in my own opinion, due to the fact that the U.S. Handled this reasonably well. I know the U.S. is being criticized right and left in how the U.S. handled the uprisings. I think, by and large, the U.S. was not in a position to affect the outcome of these uprisings. These were not about America in the first place. They were not a function of what America did to make them to decide the outcome, including in Egypt in particular, where the U.S. Was accused of either dumping Mubarak too early or not dumping him early enough. Frankly, I don't think it would have made a difference. What happened in Egypt was going to happen anyway. And I think one of the things that this administration did understand, to its credit, with all the mistakes that were made on multiple issues, is that you cannot make the Arab uprisings about America, because once you do that, you lose. And tied to that is a problem that we often don't fully understand. And that is the Arab public aversion to Western intervention, and particularly to American intervention, even on issues where they really want somebody to do something. And if you look at what's happening in Syria, for example, in the polling that I do in the Arab world, 90% of people that I poll in six countries say they are for the rebels against the regime. They favor the rebels against the regime. 90%. Overwhelming. Where do you get that kind of percentage? But when you ask them, as I did ask the Egyptians in May on the eve of their election, whether they want the United States or the West to intervene to bring down the Assad regime, they say, a majority say no, because they fear Western intervention even more than they fear their own dictators. And that is a real problem for American diplomacy. And that has consequences also for the relationship with Iran. Because while Arabs, many of them, are uncomfortable with Iran, some governments truly fear Iran, and some of the public truly fears Iran. And Iran has acquired more influence since the Iraq War. We helped them, obviously, by getting rid of the Taliban, that was one of their enemies first, and then getting rid of Saddam Hussein, which was the biggest enemy, second. And they've increased in power in recent years, and that is a problem that everybody's dealing with. But when you ask the Arab public, name the two countries that pose the biggest threat to you personally, and give an open question. Open question. Over 80% say Israel first. Over 70% say America second. And about 10 to 15% say Iran. So keep that in perspective. They don't like Iran, but to think that they will take America's word on what to do to deal with Iran is a leap of faith that we should not make. And for that reason, I end by saying our options are limited. We have made the mistake for a long time that we can be the world's policeman. And I think when you look at it, there was some reason to think that that was possible, particularly after the end of the Cold War. There was a euphoric moment of America. Many of us thought it was the end of history. The end of history meaning not only that democracy won over authoritarianism, but that America won the war on the Soviet Union and emerged supreme in the 1990s as an unchallenged superpower, leading global economic growth in an era of globalization, that we're only going to expand the power and influence. And we saw what we're able to do, whether it was in the first Iraq War or in Yugoslavia or economically in mobilizing people. But in the past decade, all of that is behind us. We know the story, and the story is that really no one sees America that way, and we don't see ourselves that way, and the American public doesn't see us that way. And the reality of it is, America is still a very powerful and important country, and it has very many bright years ahead, particularly with the right choices. But there is no going back to the role of thinking that we're in a position alone or with a limited number of allies to control the tide of history in a place like the Middle East. And I think we will do well by helping on the margin, protecting our interests where it matters most, but mostly allowing people to seek their own destiny, allowing people the opportunity to find ways to raise their heads high as they chanted in those revolutions. Thank you very much.
You said that in the poll that you took, 75% of the respondents said that they feared America or hated America. I don't understand. Why is it that they fear us and hate us so much?
No, they didn't say they hated America. They said they feared America. That is what who poses the biggest threat to you? That's the question. So it's not about hate. It's really about anger. And we have that in unfavorable views of the U.S. But the reason for it is that we're thinking about what it is that we think we're doing. Most of them view it through America's actions. If you think about just the Iraq War itself in 2003, the overwhelming majority of them didn't want to see that Iraq War. They thought it would go against, you know, their interest. They thought it would kill a lot of people. Most of them understood the U.S. went ahead and carried out that war with some allies, but without U.N. backing or legitimacy. When you look at the outcome of that war, what do they see? They see hundreds of thousands of Iraqis influenced by this. In fact, millions, if you consider the refugees. Lives disrupted. Iraq, a vibrant, powerful leader in the Arab world, is now a shadow of itself. They see mostly Sunnis, and most Arabs are Sunnis. The Sunnis losing power in in Iraq. They see the rise of Iran as a power that they think is a function of the devastation in Iraq. So that's one thing. The other thing is, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is the prism through which they see the United States, by and large. They don't like American policy on this issue. They think the U.S. Is responsible for the continuation of the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, in large part because they believe that Israel wouldn't be able to sustain it without American support. So they blame America for what Israel does. And those are the two biggest prisms, by the way. But when you ask them, what do you think America is trying to do in the Middle East? Most people didn't believe that we were trying to spread democracy in the region, no matter what we said. They just had no trust. In all of the polls that we've done, the two issues that matter most to them are the Arab-Israeli issue and the presence of American forces in the Gulf. The Iraq war is tied to that. And so that's how they make up their minds.
Could you share with us insights that I'm sure you have about really some of the fundamental differences between the Shiites and the other groups that are they seem to be so angry at one another as well? And it's just hard for me to understand what is the fundamental mechanism that separates these different religious groups.
Have you ever heard of the war in Ireland? And the point that I'm trying to make actually is, yes, of course there are some historical divisions between Shiites and Sunnis and theological divisions dating back to the origins of Islam itself. And those are important. They continue to be important. But at the core, in almost every one of the cases, in each one of the countries, including Iraq itself and Lebanon itself, it is as usual about a power struggle that both sides used for where sectarianism is used for one side or the other. And even in, if you look at Lebanon, for example, if you look at public opinion, there's definitely a divide between Sunnis and Shia. They have different views of multiple issues. But when you look at the struggle that's ongoing, it's not so much a theological struggle. It is a struggle, a communal struggle. It is in part obviously related to foreign intervention, particularly in the case of Lebanon, where the Shia, particularly Hezbollah, gets support from Iran. So foreign intervention matters, and many of the other groups get support from Saudi Arabia or the U.S. There is that as well. But by and large, it is also a political struggle inside. The Shia today are a plurality of the population in Lebanon, the largest single group in a multi-ethnic state where Christians and Sunnis and Druze and Shia live together. And the Shia had been politically at a disadvantage for decades. They've been empowered only really in the past 20, 30 years, and they're asserting themselves. And so there is that internal power struggle that has taken place everywhere. And the same could be said up to a point about Iraq. So it is definitely a factor. There is a religious and social divide and political divide between Sunnis and Shia, but it is often not the main reason that is driving attitudes. In Bahrain, for example, you have a monarchy that is based on a Sunni minority. You have a majority who are Shia. So, of course, the government will benefit from this issue looking like it's a Sunni-Shia issue because it can then rally a lot of Sunnis from the outside. So we have to keep that in mind, that it's not really a straightforward division of Sunnis and Shia.
Okay, the gentleman over here, please. Okay.
Very briefly, given that Hamas and Hezbollah have both indicated that they would never accept Israel as a state, do you think we'll ever see peace between the Palestinian and the Israelis in our lifetime?
Thank you.
If you ask me that question, 5 years ago, I would have said yes. If you asked me that question 10 years ago, I'd have said yes. I'm actually always an optimist on this issue. And I participated on the American side of mediation between Israelis and Palestinians. And I have a pretty good sense of where they are and where they have been. And on the public opinion side, there's some reason to be somewhat optimistic. For example, despite what Hamas says or Hezbollah says, when you ask Palestinians and when you ask Arabs outside of the Palestinian areas, including in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, whether they are prepared to accept a two-state solution in which you have Israel as a state, recognized state, and then Palestine state in the West Bank and Gaza, two-thirds consistently say yes, including in the poll in October 2011. And among Israelis, you still have a majority or a plurality say yes to a two-state solution. So at the one hand, you have a public opinion that hasn't given up on the two-state solution. But here's the other side of the story. When you ask them, do you believe that the two-state solution will ever happen? You have 55% on both sides say it will never happen. And so the fact is that they want it, but they don't think it's going to happen, partly because they think the other side is the bad side and not going to allow it to happen. What do? You start preparing for conflict instead of preparing yourself for peace, and you get caught in a catch-22. That's where we're at. Now, I do think that it's not just that, that there is a historical process, there is an argument to be made that it's no longer possible to have a two-state solution. A lot of people make that. I haven't made that argument yet. And sometimes I wonder whether I'm making my mind up through my heart instead of my brain. Because when I analyze it analytically, I would have to say to myself, I don't see it. I don't see where the breakthrough is going to happen. I don't see America making this a priority, enough of a priority to put all the weight behind it. I don't see leadership on the Israeli side that are capable of making the right compromises. I see the Palestinians divided, and I see the Arab world in turmoil. So that's the reason for pessimism, not really what people say. Remember, the PLO used to say, we will never recognize Israel. They did. The Israelis used to say, we will never recognize the PLO. It's a terrorist group. They did. So those things change. It is the strategic environment in which they operate that you have to assess. It is very difficult to see the prospects, especially given the expanding settlements on the West Bank and Gaza, but in the West Bank, not in Gaza, and East Jerusalem, because it's getting to a point where it's very hard to see how you could carve out a viable Palestinian state that would be along the line of the minimally acceptable size on the Arab side. And if I look at Israeli politics and I see what happened over the past 4 years with a right-wing government that is now probably, according to the latest poll, likely to get reelected in January, I just don't see an Israeli decision moving in that direction. And so, all in all, this is not an optimistic moment. But I will say one thing that I think I always remind myself when I reach this point of deadlock mentally. And maybe that's why I'm always an optimist. I say to myself, when you look at the historical breakthroughs that happened, all of them, we were just talking about how people didn't even expect the uprisings in the Arab world. But when you look, for example, at the Israeli-Egyptian breakthrough, when Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, whose title I hold in my chair, essentially out of nowhere came out and offered a peace deal to Israel and clinched a peace treaty with Israel, no one expected it. I urge you to look at the pessimism that was pervasive in the days before. When you look even at the breakthrough in 1993 between Israel and the Palestinians, no one really expected it, and it happened. And it shocked people, and it was quite an extraordinary moment in history. We don't expect those kind of moments in history. They happen because suddenly you have courageous leaders who break the stalemate and sway the public, because the public makes an assessment like which I just said, which is, oh, it's not going to happen, therefore I may as well prepare for war. But if you persuade them it is going to happen, they change their mind. But you need that leadership. Where it's going to come from, I don't know. I don't see it in the short term, but I hope it does come from somewhere.
In Tunisia, where it all started, and which had a tremendous impact, influence on the actions of other Arab countries, the Salafists are engaging in considerable violence. And I wonder if you feel that this is a threat to the Tunisian state, and if so, what impact, if any, would there be on some of the other Arab states?
No, that's a good question, because we talked about the empowerment of the people through the Arab uprisings. One group that was definitely empowered through the Arab uprising is the Salafis. In fact, when you look at the Egyptian, not just the Tunisian, if you look at the Egyptian case, if you asked Egyptian analysts what was the biggest surprise in the parliamentary elections, the first parliamentary elections that Egypt held, they will tell you it's not the Brotherhood getting a majority. That was not a surprise for a lot of people. That was sort of expected. We knew the Muslim Brotherhood had a strong organization. It's that suddenly there was this Salafi organization that people didn't even know had such a political appeal, that ran and got nearly a quarter of the vote. And so the Salafis are now part, a fact of life, and they've been empowered through this revolution in Egypt and elsewhere, and certainly in Tunisia. And certainly the liberal Islamists, including al-Nahda in Tunisia, see them potentially as a threat to the kind of state that they want to put in place. And sure, they are as a force, what they are putting forth is very much different, not only from the liberal forces in society, but also even the mainstream, more moderate Islamist forces, and everybody's going to have to contend with that. For now, they're a minority. Now, whether or not they use violence and that changes the environment critically, we don't know. But the moderate Islamist forces, particularly in Tunisia, have actually been very interesting, both in terms of how they've managed their majority in the parliament, how they've managed the debate over the constitution, and particularly the makeup of the constitution, the role of religion in politics, very moderately, and even the laws for the parliamentary elections. One of the things that happened in Tunisia is today, in this era where an Islamist party has a majority in parliament, what you have is more women in the Tunisian parliament than you had before the revolution. And the reason for it is that this Islamist party, al-Nahda, agreed with others to have a law that stipulated that every list of candidates that will be put forth by any party for parliamentary candidates would have to have every other candidate be a woman. And so they forced it upon them, and that's what happened in that particular order. So there are a lot of positive things to look for in Tunisia, but there are also dangers of the threats, which tells you the story of the Arab Spring.
All right, thank you very much.